Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. Indonesian police say a suspected terrorist was killed and at least two others arrested Friday. Police said they conducted raids at multiple locations in the wake of the downtown Jakarta fatal attack the previous day. Some of those who were targeted in the raids were linked to the Islamic State, which has claimed responsibility for Thursday's violence. VOA correspondent Steve Herman is in Jakarta, and he describes a vigil held there Friday.
There was one back at the site of the attack. They united under a banner. This was an ad hoc group that was quickly formed. And their banner read, "We are not afraid." They were also quite a bit defiant with some yelling, "Kill the terrorists," and that sort of thing. But for others there, it was a time for prayers. They left roses right in front of the Starbucks where there had been some casualties.
Indonesia's national police chief revealed on Friday that one of the perpetrators who died Thursday had previously been arrested for possessing ammunition during a visit to the country by U.S. President Barack Obama. Witnesses in Somalia's Gedo region say al-Shabaab militants attacked an African Union military base Friday near the town of El Ade, some 60 kilometers south of the regional capital. What was believed to have been a suicide bombing was followed by a firefight with Kenyan troops stationed at the base. Witnesses told VOA the attackers rammed at least four cars filled with explosives into the main gate of the southern Somali base. The blasts were followed by heavy gunfire. This is VOA News. An official in Sierra Leone says a corpse has tested positive for the Ebola virus just a day after the World Health Organization declared an end to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. The WHO said in a statement Friday that it confirms the Ebola case in Sierra Leone, which was detected in the body of a woman who became ill and died earlier this month. On Thursday, the World Health Organization, at a news briefing in Geneva, announced an end to the Ebola virus outbreak in Liberia, meaning all three countries at the epicenter of the West African outbreak were considered Ebola-free. WHO Emergency Response Director Rick Brennan cautioned that the Ebola risk remains.
We've learned a lot about the Ebola virus over the last year or two. And what we have observed is that the virus can persist in the body fluids of a proportion of survivors. Most importantly, it can persist in the semen of male survivors for a period of up to 12 months.
The WHO tells the French news agency that the victim was a 22-year-old female student who had taken ill near the Guinean border Thursday last week and died on Tuesday. The top Republican presidential contenders clashed over foreign policy and economic issues Thursday, as well as at each other in their sixth debate, this one held in South Carolina. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
There was a smaller field of candidates on hand for the South Carolina debate, and it led to a number of lively exchanges among the contenders. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush challenged frontrunner Donald Trump over his proposal to ban non-American Muslims from coming to the United States.
I hope you reconsider this, because this policy is a policy that makes it impossible to build the coalition necessary to take out ISIS.
I want security for this country. We have a serious problem with, as you know, with radical Islam. We have a tremendous problem. It's not only a problem here, it's a problem all over the world.
As a group, there was widespread condemnation of President Obama's foreign policy and warnings that Democrat Hillary Clinton would continue them. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
India's capital is ending its car experiment Friday that was designed to reduce the city's record-breaking air pollution. The experiment, which began at the beginning of the year in New Delhi, required cars with even and odd-numbered license plates to be on the roads at different times. The Delhi government said the city's pollution dropped by more than 50% during the past 2 weeks. However, it was not immediately clear how the results were measured or whether the odd-even scheme could become permanent. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The UN Human Rights Chief warns that the crisis in Burundi is increasingly taking on an ethnic dimension. He says he has evidence women have been sexually violated by security forces because of their Tutsi ethnicity.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up. Also in the news, Al-Shabaab militants attacked an African Union military base today, killing at least 40 Kenyan soldiers. And Ethiopia is being hard hit by the El Nino weather phenomenon. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Top story this hour, witnesses in Somalia's Gedo region say Al-Shabaab militants attacked an African Union military base today near the town of El Ad, some 60 kilometers south of the regional capital, Garbari. What was believed to have been a suicide bombing was followed by a firefight with Kenyan troops stationed at the base. Witnesses told VOA the attackers rammed at least four cars filled with explosives into the main gate of the southern Somali base. The blasts were followed by heavy gunfire between the attackers and Kenyan soldiers. Al-Shabaab says it killed more than 60 Kenyan troops. Deputy Gedo Governor Mohamed Hussein Isaac told VOA that at least 40 Kenyan soldiers were killed and said some troops managed to escape the base. The African Union mission in Somalia, known as AMISOM, confirmed the attack but refused to give details. Kenyan Defense Forces said in a statement that Al-Shabaab militia attacked the Somalian army base near the Kenyan forces base. The statement said the militants overran the camp at the Kenyans counterattacked in support of the Somali troops. The statement said fighting is ongoing. Residents say Al-Shabaab has taken control of the town and surrounding areas and has hoisted its flag. The residents also say the militants seized weapons on military vehicles. Al-Shabaab carried out similar attacks on AU facilities in June and in September of last year. Dozens of peacekeeping troops were killed in those attacks. The UN Human Rights Chief warns that the crisis in Burundi is increasingly taking on an ethnic dimension. He says he has evidence women have been sexually violated by security forces because of their Tutsi ethnicity. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Fears are growing that the rising ethnic divide in Burundi is beginning to resemble the situation that preceded Rwanda's 1994 genocide, which killed some 800,000 people, mainly Tutsis, by Hutus. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zeid Raad al-Hussein, is clearly worried about emerging new trends in Burundi, including cases of sexual violence by security forces and a sharp increase in forced disappearances. He warns that attacks by opposition groups against three military bases in the capital, Bujumbura, on December 11th and 12th triggered large-scale human rights violations by the government. The High Commissioner's spokesman, Rupert Colville, says the UN has documented 13 cases of sexual violence against women during search and arrest operations following the December events. He says new cases of sexual violence are continuing to emerge. He notes victims of these operations say they were targeted because they were Tutsis.
The suggestion that an ethnic dimension is now starting to emerge is reinforced by one of the sexually abused women who said that her abuser told her she was paying the price for being a Tutsi. Another witness claimed that Tutsis were systematically killed while Hutus were spared.
Colville says the UN Human Rights Office also has received numerous allegations that many young men were picked up by police and army forces during this search operation. He says many were later tortured, killed, or taken to unknown destinations. He says the High Commissioner is particularly alarmed at the increasing number of disappearances, coupled with allegations of secret detention facilities and mass graves.
Witnesses have reported the existence of at least 9 mass graves in Bujumbura and its surroundings, including one in a military camp. And together, they're believed to contain more than 100 bodies in total, all of them allegedly killed on the 11th of December.
High Commissioner Zaid is calling for an urgent, impartial investigation into the events on December 11th and 12th, including the alleged mass graves. He says it is critical for these grave sites to be safeguarded. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Ethiopia is being hard hit by the El Nino weather phenomenon. The UN Food and Agricultural Organization describes the situation as grim due to drought. More than 10 million people are reported to be food insecure as a result of repeated crop failures and the loss of livestock. The loss of most pasture land is expected as the drought continues in the new year. Food prices are rising while food stocks are falling. Pierre Vautier is FAO's surge response team leader in Ethiopia. He says there have been 2 consecutive seasons of crop failure.
The situation for the crop and the livestock is very, very concerning. In 2015, the meher and the belg season, which are the most important season in the country, failed. The production dropped by 50 to 90% in some area, in particular in the eastern region. Unfortunately, the 2016 perspective is still very concerning because after 2 consecutive seasons of failed crops, the success of the next cropping season, which will be the belg, which will start in February, will be critical.
He says crop reserves, including seeds, are severely depleted. Many Ethiopian farmers took out loans last year to replace seeds, fertilizer, and tools that were lost to floods. But after another failed crop, they have not been able to repay the loans. Vautier says the FAO's response plan would help nearly 2 million farmers and livestock keepers. It aims to complement efforts by the government and NGOs. But so far, the FAO official says that's not been enough.
Unfortunately, at the moment, the government plus the NGOs' response is not sufficient to address the most critical needs. FAO is aiming to fill where there is gaps.
FAO has presented an 18-month, $50 million plan to assist Ethiopia. More than 130,000 households would receive seeds, tools, small-scale irrigation projects, and microloans. About 290,000 households would receive emergency animal feed, vaccinations for 3 million animals, and restocking with 100,000 goats and sheep. Vautier says it's critical that donors help fund the $50 million project.
If the food is not available in the country, if the livelihood is not protected from the population, this population will move, they will emigrate within Addis Ababa, try to find job, but also abroad. So in fact, it will be for this population a crisis because they will leave their country in order to a better livelihood elsewhere. And this is a main concern.
That was Pierre Vautier, the Food and Agriculture Organization Surge Response Team Leader in Ethiopia. One day after it appeared the West Africa Ebola outbreak was over, another case has been confirmed. The World Health Organization says the latest case was discovered in Sierra Leone. The Ebola virus was confirmed in a woman who became ill and died earlier this month. Health officials are now trying to find anyone who had come in contact with her. The World Health Organization says Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone remain at high risk of additional small outbreaks of Ebola in the coming months. That's due to the virus persisting in survivors after recovery. The Ebola epidemic in West Africa took 11,000 lives and infected more than 28,500 people. Although the Ebola epidemic in West Africa is essentially over, except for some sporadic individual cases, research to find a vaccine or cure continues. The latest research shows success in using antibodies to fight Ebola infections in mice. The study was done by researchers at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York and the U.S. Army Medical Institute of Infectious Diseases. They engineered antibodies to combat the 2 deadly strains of Ebola, the Zaire and Sudan strains. Dr. Jonathan Lai is the co-leader of the study and associate professor of medicine at Einstein College. From New York, he spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about the antibody research on Ebola.
Antibodies are the workhorse of the immune system. What happens is when you or anybody else gets an infection, the body produces antibodies as a way of trying to fight off the infection. So they're protein molecules that bind to the virus and either prevent the virus from infecting new cells or help clear the virus from the body. The problem with Ebola is that the virus, once it infects a host, is able to replicate very rapidly to the point where it can very quickly overtake the immune system so that the body can't produce these types of antibodies fast enough. So the idea behind antibody therapy is to give the body a chance to get a leg up on the infection by giving additional antibody.
Why focus on those two particular strains of the Ebola virus?
Really two reasons. The first reason is because if you look at historical outbreaks from 1976 to 2012, and I don't include the 2014 and 2015 epidemic because the numbers still are being worked out in terms of the number of cases, but from 1976 to 2012 at least, the Zaire species and the Sudan species are responsible for 95% of Ebola-related deaths. In fact, before the 2014 epidemic, the largest outbreak of any Ebola virus species was actually caused by Sudan in the year 2000. So, number one, we felt that something that at least covered those two species would be a significant advance. The second reason is because those two species on the evolutionary scale are actually the furthest away from one another in terms of the properties and the amino acid alignment sequences of the glycoprotein. So we felt that if we could really bridge those two different distant species, that would be also a very good first step to be able to accomplish.
Is there a simple way to explain how you tweaked the antibodies to make them recognize and kill the Ebola virus?
Sure. So we started with two different antibodies, one that was specific for the Zaire species and one that was specific for the Sudan species. What we did was basically link the Zaire antibody with the Sudan antibody to create a two-in-one combination Zaire-Sudan antibody.
So you did this work in mice, is that correct?
Once we had produced the antibodies, we shipped them off to our collaborator, John Dye, who's at the United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, U.S. AMRID. And he works in a high containment facility, a biosafety level 4 facility, which is required for these types of pathogens. And he and his team tested the efficacy in mice.
And the outcome?
In one experiment, he took mice and challenged them with the Zaire species of the virus and then provided the combined antibody. And in a separate experiment, he took a separate batch of mice and challenged them with the Sudan Ebola virus and then provided them with the same antibody. And what he found in both cases is that he was able to observe 100% protection. In other words, none of the mice died from the Ebola virus species in either case, whereas the control groups that did not receive the antibody treatment in both groups had all died by the 10th day.
So what do you have to do next to show that this might work in humans?
Typically, therapeutics in the filovirus field are characterized first in mice, but then they have to go to some larger animals. So guinea pig models might be the next thing, and the large animal studies in non-human primates are really important to try to figure out if things would be effective in humans. And many therapeutics that do look good in mice are as effective in non-human primates. So I think it's just about doing the experiments to try to figure that out. For our lab specifically, it may be that the best broad therapeutic actually comprises a cocktail of monoclonal antibodies. In our case, the current thing that we've tested is really only a single monoclonal antibody. So for our lab, the next task is really to see what other types of antibodies we can create with these types of features, whether we can improve the activity, and then whether we can mix different engineered antibodies with the one that we've already created to try to produce an effective therapeutic cocktail that's broad for all the Ebola viruses.
Dr. Jonathan Lai is Associate Professor of Medicine at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. From New York, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kebua. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the number of women in the United States who live at risk of female genital mutilation has tripled in recent years. The new CDC report estimates that about 513,000 women and girls living in the United States have been raised in nations where female cutting is a tradition. The researchers say they do not know the exact numbers that have undergone the procedure. They believe the risk has grown fourfold for U.S. girls younger than 18. The practice, which involves removal of the external genitalia, has been illegal for 20 years in the United States. The report author says, however, their research confirms that the life-threatening tradition now happens in the United States. The World Health Organization, WHO, has estimated as many as 140 million women around the world have been subjected to the practice. 20 past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Germany's interior minister says of 19 men arrested after the New Year's Eve mob violence at Cologne's main railroad station, 10 were asylum seekers and the other 9 were believed to be in Germany illegally. An additional 32 suspects were identified by the federal police, 22 asylum seekers, 3 Germans, an American and others. Local authorities were ill-prepared to patrol the celebration that night. In related news, the International Office for Migration says 59 migrants and refugees have died trying to enter Europe in the last 14 days. The number does not include another 11 who died when 2 buses crashed in Turkey. Officials believe they were being smuggled to the Turkish coast. Austria threatens to follow Germany's lead to turn back migrants trying to get to Scandinavian countries. Interior Minister Johann Milk-Littner says migrants at Austria's border with Slovenia will not be admitted if their destination is a Scandinavian country. Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari has announced a new investigation into the 2014 kidnapping of hundreds of schoolgirls from the northeastern town of Chibok by the Boko Haram insurgent group. But parents and community members are divided over whether the new investigation will accomplish anything. Chris Stein reports from Lagos.
Nearly 2 years have passed since Boko Haram militants made off with more than 200 girls taking final exams in Nigeria's war-torn northeast. And relatives of the missing girls say many questions remain unanswered. Ayuba Alamson wants to know why the town's secondary school was opened when others had been closed because of rising Boko Haram violence. The group's quest to establish strict Islamic law in the northeast has displaced more than 2 million people and killed more than 20,000, according to the United Nations. On Thursday, Alamson was among a group of family and community members who met with President Buhari. He hopes the new inquiry will shed more light on the mass kidnapping.
So we are still demanding a comprehensive investigation to be carried out and for the results to be made known to we, parents, relations, and the whole world.
The administration of former President Goodluck Jonathan announced an initial investigation weeks after the girls were taken from Chibok. But community member Manasa Allen says the report was never released and the investigators barely even set foot in the town.
They came to Chibok in a chopper, landed, and just greeted the parents within a few minutes and they are up again. Aside that one, there was never any form of investigation.
That is why Allen says he is skeptical of what this new investigation can accomplish.
I don't see investigation that is almost 1 year plus today is going to bring out anything.
In a televised chat with journalists last month, President Buhari said the girls still have not been located. He said he would be open to negotiating with Boko Haram for the abductees if their leader could be located. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Elderly people in Cameroon say that increasingly often they are being abandoned even when they have diseases that come with old age. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé. The country is gradually leaving behind its tradition of at-home elderly care and instead creating a growing number of centers for elderly persons. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports.
72-year-old Ngai Giselle has been at Yaoundé's Bethany Viacam Center for Old, Invalid and Abandoned Persons for 4 years. She says she was abandoned by her family and two kids who, according to cultural tradition, are supposed to take care of her. Giselle says a kind stranger brought her here when she started suffering from chronic heart infections.
La famille, c'est là où Dieu te met, c'est là la famille. En venant ici, c'est un papa Jésus.
She says when she recovered from unconsciousness, she was told a Jesuit priest called Roger brought her to the center. She says she believes she is still living thanks to God's love and the family-like love she was given at the center. The center is home to 45 elderly persons. 84-year-old former teacher Jean Etundi says his daughter brought him to the center because her busy career made it impossible to take care of him.
C'est ma fille qui m'avait amené ici parce que je suis paralytique. Ma fille, elle travaille Douala.
He says his daughter got a job in Cameroon's economic capital, Douala, and could no longer live with him. He says his daughter now sends money to treat his paralysis. Ndula Pascaline, an official of the center, says it was once a social taboo in Cameroon for people to take their old parents to assisted living homes. But because of low incomes or disinterest, many people are now disregarding the old tradition.
Lorsque vous avez une personne âgée dans votre famille, elle devient une charge pour vous.
She says elderly persons become a burden on the family, and that since most youth are in search of jobs in the cities, they have no option other than to abandon their old parents in villages or in homes for the elderly. She says another group of elderly people who are abandoned are those who are accused of witchcraft practices. A 2013 study by the Central African Economic Commission and the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights found that just 10% of Cameroon's people have social insurance plans that help take care of them in their old age. Richard Ndintanto, director of the non-governmental organization Ecumenical Service for Peace, piloted the study. He says it is imperative for the government to take care of the needs of the elderly.
Well, we are going to engage stakeholders with this study so that they see exactly what is happening with the elderly around Africa, so that at least we should begin to reflect on how we can set up a system which would be able to rehabilitate elderly persons. There are people who spend their lives working to build a country, and I don't think it is good for the country to abandon them when they are at old age.
Some of the elderly in Cameroon say they never had sufficient means to prepare for retirement and old age, especially after Cameroon's currency suffered a 50% devaluation in 1994 and state workers saw their salaries cut by 60%. Social worker Mbibe Roslin says such conditions made it difficult for many people to prepare for retirement.
When they leave work and they go back to the village, they don't have what to take care of themselves, especially those who did not prepare towards their old age. So we're trying to see how we make a society that is inclusive, that will make everybody feel comfortable.
The United Nations Population Division estimates that by 2050, the number of people worldwide age 60 and over will increase to 2 billion because of improved health care. 80% of them will be living in developing countries. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
And for listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to African News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on VOA. For the full hour of African News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Al-Shabaab militants attacked an African Union military base today, killing at least 40 Kenyan soldiers. And Ethiopia is being hard hit by the El Nino weather phenomenon. Coming up, music from Rwanda. And later, Catholic Relief Services working with Special Olympics in a Nairobi slum to provide support to children and their parents. I'm Hayes Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA Sports with Sonny. He's next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young. Hello, Sonny.
Happy Friday, Yeheyes.
Sonny, I understand Rwanda is getting ready to host an international football tournament.
Yeheyes, let's kick off with African football. The fourth African Nations Championship begins Saturday in Kigali, Rwanda. Remember, VOA football fans, this is for locally based players in Africa. So we won't see European-based stars like Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, the Gabonese striker who was recently crowned the 2015 African Footballer of the Year and who's been banging in goals in the Bundesliga for Borussia Dortmund. The 16-team tournament in Rwanda will span 3 weeks, with the final to be played February 7th in Kigali. Joining us now for a look at the first-round groupings is our African football guru, David Legg.
Group A, based in Kigali, the matches will be in the Amahoro Stadium, which is the national stadium with a capacity of just over 20,000. Now, the seeding is Rwanda 1, because they're the host nation, Gabon 2, Morocco 3, and Ivory Coast 4. And in the opening matches, Rwanda play Ivory Coast, and then Gabon play Morocco. I've got a real problem with the seedings here, Sonny. My favorites are actually Morocco and the Ivory Coast. Of course, home advantage will help Rwanda considerably, but the Moroccans and the Ivorians were particularly impressive in their qualifying programs. So it's going to be fascinating to see how these opening matches on Saturday unfold. For all our listeners in East Africa, Rwanda play Ivory Coast at 1300 GMT. That's 3 p.m. Rwandan time. And then 3 hours later at 1600 GMT or 6 o'clock Rwandan time, it's Gabon against Morocco. On to Sunday, Sonny, and the venue this time is Butare. Here, the seedings in Group B are 1, DR Congo, 2, Angola, 3, Cameroon, and 4, Ethiopia. My favorites to go through this group are DR Congo and Cameroon. In the opening matches, it's DR Congo against Ethiopia at 3 p.m. local time, and then Angola against Cameroon 3 hours later. Group C, of course, will have huge interest for many listeners to the sunny side of sport, because among the teams are Nigeria. Nigeria, arguably the favorites to win this competition, but they're not the top seeds. That position is filled by Tunisia. Nigeria are the second seeds, based on the fact that they finished third in 2014 in South Africa. The third seeds are Niger, and the fourth seeds are Guinea. And in the opening matches on Monday, it's Guinea against Tunisia, followed by Niger against Nigeria. Now, I'm sure most Nigerian football fans don't need any reminder, Sonny, that it was Niger a couple of tournaments ago who caused a sensation by eliminating Nigeria from the qualifying competition for the African Nations Championship, which is also known in short as the CHAN. So I think it's going to be a very wary Nigerian side that will take on Niger. But that said, the Nigerians must be favorites to win this match and also go through to the quarterfinals, I would expect, with Tunisia. The final group, Group D, is in Gisenyi. And the seedings here are Zimbabwe 1, Mali 2, Uganda 3, and Zambia 4. This is a particularly difficult group to call. I'm at a loss, Sonny, really. I think Uganda could be one of the two qualifiers, possibly with Zimbabwe. Anyway, the opening matches, we've got some really appetizing ones. First of all, it's Zambia against Zimbabwe. That's two neighbors battling it out. And that will be followed by Mali against Uganda. And I'm going to be watching very closely in that match, Sonny, a certain 18-year-old in the Ugandan midfield, and that will be Farouk Mia. He's another name that we've been punting strongly on the Voice of America. Very promising young player, recently scored 3 goals in a World Cup qualifier as Uganda eliminated Togo. And he's certainly, to me, one to watch in 2016. So in Group D, all eyes on Farouk Mia. So we have two matches, Sonny, on Saturday, Sunday, Monday and Tuesday. So after that, perhaps the air will have cleared a little bit. But it strikes me as a very open competition. I think it's a very brave person at this stage who would boldly predict who's going to win. If you just rewind quickly to 2014 in South Africa, nobody gave Libya a chance. And amazingly, Libya won the competition by winning just one of their 6 matches. They drew the other 5. But what they did in the quarterfinals, semifinals, and final is they proved to be experts when it came to penalty shootouts, converting kick after kick. So a fascinating competition, which goes on, Sonny, right through till February the 7th. That's when we'll have the final in Kigali. And at this stage, there's absolutely no chance that David Legge is going to stick his neck out and predict who will be in that match. I'm simply not taking that chance, Sonny. Very open indeed.
Finally, David, do you think we'll see a few European scouts checking out the African talent in Rwanda?
I would expect so, Sonny. I mean, these are the home-based players, and it's the dream, Sonny, of every African footballer to play in Europe. There are many reasons for that. It's the media coverage, and not insignificant factor is the fact that your salary shoots up. I mean, it is a fact that Yaya Toure, what he earns at Manchester City in 1 week is more than many Africans will earn in their lifetime. That is a fact. I'm not going to go into the figures on it because they change from day to day, but nevertheless, that is the power, that is the lure of football. You can earn a staggering amount of money when you go to Europe if you get to the top reaches. I've seen some figures for Yaya, Sonny, and I have to confess, I get just a little bit jealous when I, especially at the moment with the South African rand is 23 to the British pound, so 1 British pound equals 23 rand. And when you convert what Yaya's earning, boy, that's an awful lot of money. So, yes, Sonny, I think there'll be a fair number of scouts. They'll all head for Nairobi, and then they'll get a connecting flight over to Kigali. And as we mentioned on your show previously, it's going to be really interesting to see how this little landlocked country, Rwanda, stage this tournament. They've already held the CAF Under-17 finals. They've done that well. They've done equally well the CAF Under-20 finals. The president, Paul Kagame, he is a very keen football fan, and he has said this will be a successful tournament. And on those very words alone, Sonny, I believe they will succeed. This is a man who takes personal involvement. You know, so often before a tournament, you hear this politician and that politician promising this, that, and the other. But to me, Kagame is a sleeves-rolled-up, hands-on man. I think he will have told his ministers and his football officials, I want a superb tournament, and I believe he's going to get it.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legge, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. Major League Soccer held its annual draft of college players Thursday in Baltimore, Maryland, about 64 kilometers north of our VOA headquarters here in Washington. With the first pick, the Chicago Fire selected Wake Forest midfielder Jack Harrison. The Fire then traded him to New York City FC for the number 4 choice, which Chicago used on Stanford defender Brandon Vincent. With the second pick, the Philadelphia Union chose Joshua Yarrow, a defender from Ghana who played 3 seasons for Georgetown University here in Washington.
It has been a long road and it has been a tough one. But I'm grateful for everything that happened and all the things that happened to make me who I am today. You know, coming from Ghana to Santa Barbara to Georgetown and now here and to Philly, it's been a really great road and it's been a really fun one and a learning experience and something that has helped build me up as a person. And it hasn't been easy, but at last I can look back and say it was worth it.
Joshua Yarrow says it was also worth it to focus not just on soccer at Georgetown, but also on academics. Josh is close to getting his degree in international relations and anthropology.
One thing that I'll say is, and a lot of kids that play soccer in Ghana do not really take the education seriously, and that for me it was a big thing. And so if I had one advice, it's that, you know, you can be a pro soccer player and you can have your degree or be close to being done and never really throw away your education because you never know when that's going to come in handy. And just pursue both because it's possible, and I've been through it and seen that it's tough, but at the end you're going to look back and you're going to really enjoy it.
Joshua Yarrow will now have to adapt to a much more grueling schedule in Major League Soccer, so says the soccer writer for the Washington Post newspaper, Stephen Goff.
It's always difficult with first-year players who come out of college because college soccer is just such a short season. It's 3 months, you know, maybe 20, 25 games, and you're done. MLS is a 9-month haul. So it takes a toll on rookies, especially when you get into summer and into the second half of the season. But he's a terrific athlete, and I think that gives him an advantage. He knows the game so well. He reads the game so well. And so I would imagine he will probably be a starter in this league right away. Hard to say who else Philadelphia. I mean, they've signed some foreign players also, but he's definitely in the mix to play regularly, for sure.
That's Stephen Goff, the soccer writer for the Washington Post newspaper. And Stephen was talking to VOA at the annual Major League Soccer Draft in Baltimore, Maryland. In pro boxing, undefeated WBC heavyweight champion Deontay Wilder of the USA makes his third title defense Saturday night when he fights Poland's Artur Spielka in Brooklyn, New York. How have your preparations been going, Deontay?
Well, the preparations for this fight has been crazy. It's been exciting, you know, due to the fact that Spielka wasn't my original fighter. So we was looking forward to a right-hander, and he's a southpaw, so we had to change up all our regimens from an orthodox fighter to a southpaw fighter, canceled a lot of flights, brought a lot of sparring partners in. I haven't sparred or competed against a southpaw in 3 years. So it brought back that challenge to my brain of why I love a southpaw and I love a pressure fighter too. That's the most two things I love in boxing, to face an opponent that's a southpaw and a pressure fighter. So it was great. I'm ready to perform come Saturday.
Come Saturday, Deontay Wilder will be looking for his 36th consecutive victory. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to you, Hayes Woohee.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, Catholic Relief Services working with Special Olympics in a Nairobi slum to provide support to children and their parents. And next, publishing children's books that Ethiopian kids can easily grasp and enjoy. But first, some music. Here is Manny Martin of Rwanda with Yoba Yoba.
Sinzira Yara dufite turabuzo kuruba tatu twibera mu mataba
kupira jiri nazi wachu akadukamira yera tukanwa tukanyurwa tukitetera umukuru muri twe akabina jorwa umukuriki akabina rumikwa nangi umuto muri bo maze kumugabo daterwa kundi mwana wajenge Tangira kuryana byato nato bazo tubonye bikamurenga bikamuyobera bikamushobera sogokuru yaje kuducira umugani nako n'umufindo mbambaroga afata inkoni eshatu arazibangikanya azibohesha umurungu ukomeye ati bana banjye mubaze kuba abagabo ngaho nimuvunaguriza inkoni ndeba bana banjye uburiza muri twe arazisingira zimunaniye zikikiriza ubuheta nangiuye ture nizana nkwereke ahari aho dufatanije twazivunagura inkoni zitubera ibamba ziratunanira Azifata, azikuraho wa murunga Arazikonyagura imwe ku yindi Dukora tugira tumumaze kubona abana banjye Nimuguma hamwe ntawe uzabatera Nimuguma kuryana bazabavunagura nk'izi nkoni
Annie Martin, Afrawanda with Yoba Yoba. Children in Kenya with intellectual disabilities are often seen as the result of witchcraft. Getting the attention and services they need is a difficult task, especially in slums where electricity is scarce, clean water expensive, sanitation poor, and quality education is hard to come by. Catholic Relief Service is working with Special Olympics in the Nairobi slum of Kwanguera to provide activities and a support system to these children and their parents. Jill Craig has more from the Kenyan capital.
Living in a Nairobi slum is not easy. Electricity is scarce, clean water expensive, sanitation poor, and quality education hard to come by. But for children living with disabilities, slum life becomes even more difficult.
It's one thing if you're a kid with special needs or intellectual disabilities in a developed country. But when you consider kids growing up in a slum in Nairobi or any other slum in a major urban area in Africa, there's a huge need there, I think.
Nancy McNally of Catholic Relief Services says there are additional challenges for children with disabilities in Kenya.
If they have intellectual disabilities, then sometimes they're ostracized by their own communities, by their own parents. You know, there are some superstitions that the kids might be cursed.
So to help these children and provide a support system for their parents, Catholic Relief Services and Special Olympics started a young athletes program in the Nairobi slum of Kawangware. The program caters to children with intellectual disabilities ages 2 to 7, who come to an early childhood development center twice a week to participate in activities with other children. Social workers also conduct home visits, helping parents with emotional encouragement and positive parenting techniques. At the same time, parents like Justice Idalia are able to get support from other parents dealing with similar issues. That's important because Idalia says caring for his son Jason is a round-the-clock responsibility.
These children need a very lot of care because you can't leave these children for a neighbor to take care of him. You are the one who is responsible.
Parents rarely get a break because even schooling is a problem. Anne Mushiri says many parents here cannot afford what are called special schools that service children with disabilities.
Most of them don't have a school to go to because the special schools are too expensive for them, cannot afford it. And then again, some schools don't want these children, so they just stay with them at home.
Jason's dad is unusual because most of the children's caregivers are single mothers whose husbands often leave them.
Most fathers don't like this child with a disability. Most parents, like dad, they see the child with the disability is like an outcast.
But Adalia, who is actively parenting his son, says the program has helped.
Because right now he has got a very good improvement.
There are currently 74 children in the program, and organizers say they hope to expand. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Despite having a population of almost 100 million, demand for books is low in Ethiopia. There are not many books written in the local languages, and few Ethiopians read for pleasure. Two sisters hope to buck that trend by publishing children's books that Ethiopian kids can easily grasp and enjoy. Martha van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa.
Wanting to read stories to her young children, Tsion Kiros had to rely on books written in English, as there are few Amharic language children's books available. But the story of the Tooth Fairy, for example, is very different in Ethiopia than it is in the West.
When a girl puts a tooth, or a boy, we throw it on top of the roof. And then a bird takes it, or a mouse takes it. You know, we have this whole other culture. And this is important. Our children have to know how we do things, how we see our lives.
Tsion had started a publishing house with her sister. They have published the Ethiopian version of The Tooth Fairy and other stories that reflect the country's culture and environment. Of Ethiopia's nearly 100 million people, only 49% are literate. 14-year-old Lydia Bisset loves to read books, but says most parents do not encourage kids to read. She says she reads on her own initiative, as most parents think going to school is more important than reading for pleasure. That makes it difficult for Lydia to convince her mother to buy her books that are not needed for school. Her school does have a library, but there are not many books there. The price of the newly printed books in local stores is about $1.50, affordable for middle-class Ethiopians and cheaper than previously available children books. Children's book writer Azeb Worku Sibane remembers that there was also a lack of books during her childhood. Azeb wrote a book about a red fox that goes on an adventure and simultaneously teaches kids about different modes of transport. She says a lot needs to be done to establish a reading culture in Ethiopia.
We need books, books written in Amharic or in other Ethiopian language. We need writers who can write story for children. You need specific way of writing. And we have to encourage, the cultural minister or education minister or the government or parents, they have to encourage that.
Tsion says her company printed 30,000 children books in 2015 in the two most common languages in Ethiopia, Amharic and Afan Oromifa. She says the next step is to write and publish books in tandem with the government.
They've given us a training on how to write level books and what to include, what the theme should be, what subject we should focus on. Our next step would be to use that guideline and develop storybooks.
The publishing sisters hope to establish a reading culture by focusing on young kids first, as almost half of the Ethiopian population is under the age of 15. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Pete Huntley, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States is determined to disrupt the illicit flow of money from the trade of oil and trafficking of antiquities to the terrorist group Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. Toward this end, the U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to the significant disruption of the sale and/or trade of oil and antiquities by, for, on behalf of, or to benefit ISIL. Through its illegal oil operations and trafficking in looted archaeological material from Syria and Iraq, ISIL has generated millions of dollars in hard currency, enabling it to brutalize and oppress innocent civilians. This is the first time the U.S. Secretary of State has authorized a Rewards for Justice offer for information that could be used to disrupt the sale or trade in oil and antiquities by or on behalf of a terrorist organization. Anyone with information on oil and antiquities trafficking that benefits ISIL can contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or by email at info@rewardsforjustice.net or by standard mail at Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303. USA. Individuals in North America can also call this phone number, 1-800-877-3927. All information will be kept strictly confidential. The Rewards for Justice program is administered by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Diplomatic Security. Since its inception in 1984, the program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that put terrorists behind bars or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. Follow us on Twitter at https://twitter.com/rewardsforjustice, as in the numeral 4.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. Peace talks between the Burundian government and the opposition groups have been postponed, with no word on when they may resume. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss the crisis in Burundi. That's next time on VOA Africa.
VOA News.
When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.